Hey, hey everyone. Hi, welcome to a new episode of the Making Society podcast. We talk about makers building businesses and how to be a sustainable creator of hardware projects. So welcome back for a new episode. In episode 5 of the Making Society podcast, I interview Sally Carson. She's a CEO and co-founder of Pinocchio with Eric Jennings. And together they have launched a fully open source, open hardware company around a controller, microcontroller that lets you build projects around the Internet of Things. And she will tell you more about what they do. And I met them last year, actually, at the Hardware Innovation Workshop, the event that's happening just before Maker Faire every year in the Bay Area. And we had a great chat, and I thought it would be very interesting for you to hear about their story, how they met, how they decided to build an actual product, what were some of the very early challenges they had to pick the right product idea and launch their crowdfunding campaign, which was a success. So this episode is really about the early beginnings of Maker Pro Company, how you go from simply having a passion for making or just building things in your weekend to deciding to quit your job and start a company. So that's what you will hear about in this episode. And yep, see you soon on Making Society. And you'll find all information related to this episode on makingsociety.com. So let's go to the interview now. Hi, Sally. How are you?
Hi, I'm doing great. Thanks so much for having me.
Yeah, it's great. Before to start, that you tell us about the whole story and how this whole amazing, community and product came to life, maybe you want to tell us a few words about what's Pinocchio and what's typical use case of it.
Okay, sure. Yeah, I describe Pinocchio by saying that it's a complete toolkit that entrepreneurs and makers use to create their own web-enabled products. So it's hardware as well as software. On the hardware side, we have a pocket-sized wireless microcontroller. If anybody's familiar with Arduino, that's a microcontroller. So it's a tiny computer. It talks to the internet wirelessly over Wi-Fi, and the boards also talk to each other wirelessly over mesh radio. They have inputs and outputs, so you can plug in sensors to them and pull in sensor data, or you can attach things like motors or light switches or electrical switches or robots and control these things from the web. And then on the software side, we have a web app. We call that Pinocchio HQ. That's where you can see the data coming in from your sensors, and that's where you can go to turn things on or off, or, you know, drive your web-enabled robot from your, say, your iPhone. We also have an API, so if you want to build your own web app on top of that data that your boards are pulling in, you can do that as well.
So what's a what's a typical user of a Pinocchio? What are the main uses for it?
It's a good question. So when we first started working on this product, I guess it was a project back then, you know, we thought it was going to be strictly hobbyists, makers, just kind of doing side projects on the weekends. So, and we do hear about those projects a lot from our community. So there's a lot of kegerator automation for people who are homebrewing their beer. And I guess they want to monitor the temperature on their kegerator. There's plenty of people who want to put sensors out in their garden or on their land to get environmental data. Let's see. I'm trying to think of kind of fun ones. We had a chocolatier who wanted to perfect his batch of chocolate, you know, get it the perfect temperature. Mm-hmm. And slowly over the course of talking to the community for the last year or so, we've started to find that yes, there was a hobbyist community around Pinocchio, and yes, they were makers, and they were often software developers, in fact, who are interested in getting into hardware. But many of them were entrepreneurial, and they wanted a quick way to prototype their ideas and play and make something fun on the weekends. But there was also this spirit of trying to find something that they could take to market. So these are turning out to be engineers, developers, nerds, makers who are building fun, crazy projects that are web enabled, but they're also interested in, you know, crowdfunding these projects and seeing if other people would want to purchase them, and creating their own hardware startup on our platform. So that's been a really interesting turn of events. And that's something we're really excited about because it's a parallel to our story. You know, we started as makers, hobbyists, just playing with something for fun. Mm-hmm. And then we thought, maybe this is a product that other people could take advantage of too.
Very cool. So you're a maker and, Eric too. How did you two, met and, you have a background in, electronics or not at all?
Well, I'm a maker in that I'm more on the, you know, art and design side of things. So I'm a visual artist. I'm a cartoonist. I've always been a fan of Make Magazine. I think I got the first issue, you know, the moment it came out. Mm-hmm. I was really a big fan of O'Reilly and anything that they were pushing. And so when they started talking about Make Magazine, I got really excited about this notion of creative people who were finding a way to blend their technical skill set with, you know, their computer-based technical skill set with creating things that are physical and tactile in the real world. Mm-hmm. And for me, that was very much, it was kind of, you know, a model of what I had experienced through college, where I went to school, I studied communication arts and design. So mm-hmm. I studied illustration and animation and video editing and a little bit of 3D modeling. But during that time, I also wanted to work on tactile projects, on physical real world projects. So I actually left that program for a year and spent a year in sculpture. And I what I wanted to do was blend those two. I wanted to bring them together, but at that time, those two departments were really siloed. So I spent a year in sculpture and ultimately came back to communication arts and finished my degree in that. But, you know, in retrospect, it seems very clear now. At the time, I was kind of trying to figure out my direction, what I wanted to do. But now mm-hmm. I see that I was wrestling with this, you know, I want to be technical. I want to use computers, but I also want to build real things in the real world.
Mm-hmm. So you worked for a few startups, right?
And, that's right. Yeah.
And did you also have you were developing projects on the side as well? Or how did you come to this to Arduino and microcontrollers and things like that, coming
right.
from your background?
Yeah, I think I can tell you a little bit about how I stumbled into that, and then I never answered your question about like the genesis of how Eric and I came to work together. So I can talk about that too.
Sure.
Yeah, so at that time when I was in school, our sculpture department was doing really interesting stuff. I was an undergrad, but the master's students were doing really ambitious robotics projects. And I didn't have access to the tools. You know, we weren't allowed as undergrads that weren't trained yet to use some of their like bigger welding machines. I mean, they essentially had a tech shop, you know, a maker space mm-hmm. for this sculpture department. This was at the Virginia Commonwealth University. So they've got like number two graduate level sculpture program in the country. Mm-hmm. So they were starting to do stuff like working, I think, with the School of Engineering to build these crazy robotics projects. Arduino wasn't around quite yet. So I think, I don't know what they were using platform wise to build these things, but I was totally fascinated. I was completely jealous that like as an undergrad, I wasn't allowed to touch this stuff quite yet. But I was fascinated and I was always kind of hanging out where the grad students were, like watching what they were working on, asking tons of questions. And I think I was taking like mold making classes, you know, silicone molds and rubber molds. So let's see. So Make Magazine came out, I guess that would have been something like 2005. And prior to that, I was a web designer. I was working for a company in Virginia called Crutchfield. And I had heard about the Institute, the Interaction Design Institute of Ivrea in Italy. Mm-hmm. I think this was before Make came out. And I found it via one guy's blog, one of the students' blogs. And his blog was really beautifully designed, and I was so fascinated. They were using what would eventually become the Arduino platform to prototype product design ideas and then basically do user testing with them, you know, to kind of play with the interaction and play with the timing, and iterate and refine it from there. So this was again a case of people who were, you know, computer savvy. They were technologists, but they were building real world objects. And they were using this platform that was processing in Arduino. So at the time I was like, man, I really want to get, you know, I'm doing this. I have a great job. I'm a web designer for e-commerce company. I'm not super passionate about e-commerce. I really want to be deeper in the tech industry. And at that point, I honestly was like, I kind of want to just apply to Ivrea and go there. That wasn't really like feasible for me to like leave the country, and go study abroad for a couple years.
Move to Italy.
Yeah. And so in the meantime, I was kind of exploring and trying to figure out what the next phase of my career would be. And I ended up getting a job at Yahoo in California. Mm-hmm. And, you know, meantime, in the course of me moving out there, I think Ivrea, I don't know if it was completely disbanded. I think it was absorbed by another institute in Italy.
Yeah, I think they had to close or something like that.
Okay, yeah, which is a total shame. I mean, it was so cool. Weren't they like in the Olivetti factories? Like the history is really neat.
Mm-hmm. And I think they decided to open source Arduino because of this school that was closing. So it was a way to make the project available for more people in case of, you know, the school was not there anymore.
That's so cool. I love that. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I love that ethos of just sharing. I love that the students were blogging at the time. That was pretty progressive for, I guess, 2005 to be sharing so openly what they were working on.
Yeah.
And it allowed for me, just like a random person in Virginia, to learn about this world and see what they were doing. Mm-hmm.
So how did you meet Eric?
So I guess
in California, like, maybe.
Kind of. Yeah. Flash forward a few years. I've moved around a bit since then. So I was in LA with Yahoo. Later, I moved up to San Francisco and I worked for a startup up there. And then October 2008 happened and there were a bunch of layoffs at my company. I got laid off, like most of the team got laid off. Mm-hmm. And then I just decided to go freelance. And I'd been specializing in interaction design at Yahoo. And, you know, from then on in my career, I was an interaction designer. And that kind of does like a whole nother story. But our industry kind of, you know, was wrestling with what do we call this position? And it slowly became user experience designer. So that was my specialty. And I, around that time, like fall of 2008, I just went to work as a freelance user experience designer in the Bay Area. And I spent the next, I guess, 5 years, four and a half, five years just working as a freelance designer for different Bay Area startups and technology companies.
At this time, did you spend time in hackerspaces or makerspaces? Did you try to meet other people interested by, fast prototyping and electronics and design of objects?
It's funny. I think at that time I was getting so deep into the tech industry that I was still reading Make Magazine. I was still, you know, watching that, that community form, but I wasn't deeply embedded in makerspaces or hackerspaces in SF. I think I went deeper on the like tech industry, web industry side of things. Mm-hmm. And that was definitely enough to like keep me busy, meeting people, you know, and learning from them. There's kind of like some of the best and brightest I feel like are in SF. And I luckily was able to meet a lot of those folks and learn from them and kind of, mm-hmm. you know, that time was sort of like my grad school. It was just like being in SF, working as a designer, mm-hmm. Meeting people who were super talented and just learning from them. Mm-hmm. But I was like going to Maker Fair and, like, I think I went to the second Maker Fair in the Bay. Mm-hmm. And I was like super blown away. Like I didn't realize that the community was so huge, and I guess there's a big Burning Man component. I didn't really realize mm-hmm. that's what that was at the time, but that's what I was looking at. Mm-hmm. So super inspired. And yeah, so I was kind of like, I don't know. I was at odds. Like I had my professional career working on the web, and then I had this like passion, hobby, interest thing that I wasn't, able to super cultivate on the side, which is like the maker movement, but mm-hmm. it was always there like in the background. And I was always kind of like wistful, longing to spend more time with that.
So what was the key time, you know, like the time that where you shifted and you started developing or at least having ideas? Did Pinocchio came as a like spontaneous idea at some point?
Right. Yeah. So I think
that started.
Yeah, Eric and I met via the last freelance project that I worked on. And it was the last one because I worked on Pinocchio after that. So I got hired by a company in the Bay called Singly. And like a simple way to describe what they were doing is one API to rule them all. So they're taking all these different APIs and kind of creating one Uber API that you could plug into. So you could easily get access to like data from Facebook or Instagram or Twitter, et cetera. Yeah, so we launched it, and kind of meantime while we're working on this, I think it was kind of like a part-time project for me. I don't remember how many hours I had given Singly, maybe 15 or 20 hours a week. So meantime, Eric and I are getting to know each other, and we're chatting about, you know, what our hobbies are and what we're interested in, what we're passionate about. And it turns out we're both like really interested in the maker movement. He's a total maker. He's got like a CS and a electrical engineering background. And he's like, I was working on a personal project at the time, but I'm not like a strong enough developer to do the actual code part. So I was working on a mobile app for bicycle touring, and it was just kind of an idea. I was just playing with it, just something creative to do. And he was working on this, what I would call like a remote sensor network project at home. He wanted an easy way to just automate his sprinklers in his garden. Water conservation is a really big issue in Reno, so that's where he is. And if he could intelligently, you know, check the soil moisture and then check the web to see if it's going to rain, you know, and then just water at a time when it's most efficient and environmentally friendly. That was his goal. And so we were like, well, let's barter time. Like, he felt like he could use some design resources on his sensor network. I could use some engineering help on my bicycle touring app. And I think like, I've probably told this story elsewhere. But I worked on his thing for probably like, I worked on the remote sensor network for maybe like 2 weeks. And then I was just like, this is awesome. We should just work on your idea. Yeah. And that was the genesis. And in fact, like early on, we even thought like, okay, like it, could this possibly be a product? And if so, is it just a soil moisture product? Is it a, you know, automate your sprinklers product? And we even started digging into that. We were getting great support from mentors. Eric went and toured the Desert Research Institute in Nevada, you know, and talked to them about what they need and what tools they're using now. So I guess this would have been the fall of 2012, maybe like late summer, early fall of 2012. So we're digging into the soil moisture idea, and we're having phone calls with people who are in that space. And it was wonderful. Like, we're getting a lot of support and enthusiasm around this idea, but a couple of things happened. Folks that we were talking to, it just felt so foreign to us. Like, the types of things they were describing, the culture of the space, it was such a departure from what we had known in the tech industry. I don't know if it was political or not, but just the vibe, like the culture was super different. So it felt like we're in, you know, really foreign waters. It felt uncomfortable. It felt unnatural. And then when we started to talk to mentors about, okay, what does this look like? Like, bringing something like this to market, you know, we're going to have to get you into Lowe's and Home Depot. And like, all of that felt very top heavy and foreign as well. We were just not really psyched about what the next few years looked like, you know, about bringing a consumer product to market and just being another piece of plastic on the shelves in a big box store. Like, that didn't get us jazzed. We definitely, we're really conscientious about the fact that we are producing more physical goods in the world. And I think Eric and I both take that really seriously. Like, we don't want to create more garbage. We want to create something that ultimately is a positive, you know, for the world. And so once we started to get deeper into like, what does it look like to execute on a product like this? We just were like, you know, I can definitely get behind the idea of water conservation. I think that's a noble cause, but I'm not passionate about sprinklers. Like, I don't think I can sustain a deep passion about that for the years to come. So we were like, why does it have to be that? Like, can't this just be a platform in general for other people to build whatever they want on? Like, all the tech is there. The essential promise is that we've got hardware talking wirelessly to the web. And that essentially it's like a software product. We just created the hardware that was necessary to support the software experience that we wanted to create. And I think once we arrived at that, we were like, duh, like our customers are makers who we that's us. And we love these people and we're super passionate about what they do. And just talking about zooming out and making a platform mm-hmm. that allows other people to create things, like people that are smarter than us, I think that got us really excited. And so we were just kind of paying attention to like our emotional mm-hmm. response. I think like enthusiasm is contagious, you know, like whatever emotion is coming at us, we tend to mirror that back and we feel what the person communicating to us is feeling. And I don't think we could have faked it, you know, for 5 years doing a sprinkler startup that we weren't psyched about. And like, I don't know, I even sort of, I was thinking a lot about like, okay, the customer is going to be someone like in the suburbs, probably with a grass lawn. And I felt myself like kind of like tightening up, you know, like my chest tightening up where I'm like, I don't even think people should have grass lawns. Like, yes, we're creating a product that saves water, but I totally don't believe in grass lawns. I think it's super wasteful. I think it's like, it's terrible. All the chemicals people lay down to make it green. It's just like a weird cultural thing in America. Like that's kind of an ideal of the grass lawn. It's sort of a 50s thing that's stuck around, and it's much better to have like clover, you know, there's much better. That's like a nitrogen fixing plant. So even just thinking about like, I don't want to serve customers that I have this implicit disdain for. I want to like love my customers and like cheer them on and do whatever I can to support mm-hmm. what they're trying to achieve, you know?
Mm-hmm. So did this, this shift or this, a new frame of what the product you wanted it to be. Did it change the prototyping phase in a big way? Yeah. What were the, you know, how many iterations did you have on this product idea and this whole time of thinking of your market and where you want to go? How long did that take?
Oh gosh. I mean, I think at the point where we were talking to people about soil moisture, it was smart what we did, I think. Like what we did was we tried to really talk to people who knew that space really well, who could connect us with other people who were already participating in that space. And what we tried to do is essentially spend a month really digging into that problem and see if it was something that excited us, to see if there was a market opportunity. But at that point, product-wise, it was not smoke and mirrors, but it was essentially still just like the platform, the Pinocchio platform, but nothing bespoke had been done for soil moisture. And in fact, part of the challenge of that time was for the soil moisture thing, we were getting nothing but positive feedback and enthusiasm from the folks we were talking to. They were like, there's absolutely a market here. There's tons of money to be made. Whereas, so it's a temptation, right? And like, once we started working on a platform for making whatever, we didn't get the same kinds of enthusiasm. Like the people who will use this end product get it. And they're like, yes, I've been needing this for years. Oh my gosh, you've solved this problem for me. But we didn't get the same kind of like, oh, there's lots of money to be made here. We got more like warnings from mentors and smart people who were like, this is a really big bet and it's really risky. I don't know. Like, are you sure you want to do this?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. The market is smaller. Yeah.
Totally. Yeah. So we totally had to just like go with our guts and go with our hearts. But I think prototyping, I should ask Eric. I know that we've at least done, I don't know, like probably 12 revisions at this point. Probably about a revision a month for a solid year at least. It's probably beyond that now. But yeah, I mean, prototyping in hardware is really slow, you know, because if you find a bug, you have to order a new PCB and like order all your components. And Eric was hand assembling these boards and the components are tiny. They're just like one step up from being an inhalant risk. Like once the components get one step smaller, you have to be careful about not accidentally breathing them in. That's how tiny they are.
Did you work with special tools? What was your setup for this prototype phase?
I think he'd be a better person to talk in depth about it, but he was using like a hot plate and a jeweler's loop on his eye to magnify and like tiny tweezers. So it, like when you show the hand assembled boards to people that know what they're doing in this space, they're like, what? You hand assembled these, you know? And I think he must have put together, like aside from the iterations, we wanted to get really, really early kits to like friends who could give us feedback and kind of hack on it and try to break it. So he built, I think, 8 kits early on. So 16 mm-hmm. extra boards on top of just like the prototypes. And it's just like grueling work. Like you have to get up early while your eyes are fresh, when you're not tired, caffeinate a little bit just to be sharp, but not too much because you can't have shaky hands at all. Yeah, those boards, we kind of wanted like a history of like, here's all the iterations of the boards, like to be able to lay them out and have like mm-hmm. a hall of fame, you know, like here's version 1, version 2. But we're so like thrifty with spending money that we cannibalize the chips off the mm-hmm. previous boards. So you'll see like version 2 is assembled, but it's not usable because we like took the chip back off of it to use it for version 3 again. Mm-hmm. It's pretty funny.
Do you know roughly how much you spend on the prototyping phase?
I don't know off the top of my head. If I had to guess, gosh, I don't know. Maybe 1,000 or something.
Oh, okay. That's bad. That's not bad.
Not ridiculous. Yeah, when you're hand assembling, I know that the PCBs are much more expensive when you're doing smaller runs. But I think we were working with Lane at Oshpark, and that's a nice way to mm-hmm. do it on the cheap. When you see these images of purple PCBs, which is like what you see of our early prototypes. Our boards are white now, but our early prototypes were purple. That's like a tip of the hat to mm-hmm. Lane at Oshpark, you know, when you see purple PCB, mm-hmm. that's his work.
So when did the Indiegogo campaign idea came, you know, at which did you have in mind this idea of doing a crowdfunding campaign at some point? It was something you knew about and you wanted to do, or it came late in the prototyping phase? Like, how did you start thinking of it and getting organized for it?
Sure. Yeah. So I guess, okay. So we decided not to do soil moisture late summer, early fall 2012. And then our next step was, okay, we want to do a platform for makers. Do other people want this? You know, like we built this project as a scratch your own itch kind of thing. And you know, we were finding other use cases. Like Eric had some squatters in the house next door, and they were maybe kind of scuzzy people, not folks that he felt safe having his children, you know, right next door to. And he had to head to the bay to work for Singly. And he was like, oh, if I could just have like a motion detector in my backyard, you know, by my back gate that just sent me a text message if it was, triggered. And Pinocchio was not quite at the stage where you could just spin that up that quickly. So he was like, having to leave for the bay in a few hours and trying to like hack on Arduino, I think with Wi-Fi maybe, trying to get it to work. So we were continuing to find cases like that where we were like, ooh, if we had Pinocchio right now, we'd use it for this. But we wanted to make sure that other people also needed this thing before we pursued it as a mm-hmm. as a product idea. So the first thing we did was we went to, let's see, the World Maker Fair in New York mm-hmm. in 2012. Went to the Open Source Hardware Summit, and then we went to another open source, I always forget the name of this one, another workshop that was like open source hardware, that was kind of our target audience. And we brought some early prototypes to show to them, and we brought like a poster to the Open Source Hardware Summit to kind of give a taste of mm-hmm. what we were trying to build. But mostly what we were doing was trying to find our target customer and just interview them, you know, just talk to them about, were they currently building things that had hardware talking to the web? If so, what tools were they using? What was working well? What wasn't? Like, was it still difficult? Just to try and see mm-hmm. if there was an unmet need. And interestingly, we also talked to people who wanted to build those types of projects, but they were just like, man, the barrier to entry is too high. Like, I'm interested in, I don't know, like, you know, remote sensor networks for scientific research, but I'm not super passionate about figuring out the plumbing mm-hmm. of hardware to the web. Like, I'm interested in the science part. Mm-hmm. So all of those interviews and I'd say like informal ethnography led to us feeling like, okay, there's definitely an unmet need here. Other people are kind of having the same problems we're having.
Did you, in terms of method, did you have a certain number of people you wanted to ask questions to, or, did you have a method that you followed, or you just talked around and, you know, like more like an informal conversation all around?
Yeah, okay. Totally informal. Yeah, I didn't want anybody to feel like they were being interviewed uh-huh. in a formal way, because I didn't want them to start to get conscientious about why I was asking these questions. And, you know, maybe one of the least useful things you can ask someone is like, do you think you would buy this? Like, do you think you would buy Pinocchio? Because people are just bad about self, they're bad about guessing their own behavior, what their behavior will be. And so you can get much more specific and accurate data if you ask them about what their past behavior was. So I'd just ask them stuff like, what's your favorite project you've ever built? Or like, what's the last, what are you working on right now? And just dig and like, let the questions be super open-ended. So that they didn't start to get a sense of like what the answer was I was looking for. I just wanted it to be open and exploratory, and that increases the chance that you get some unexpected nugget of insight.
So with this information, you come back home and you decide to go for it.
Yeah. We came back home and we were like, okay, I feel totally confident now that there's this unmet need that we can fill. We crafted a couple of personas, which are like biographies of user archetypes, customer archetypes, based on the interview data that we collected. And that's just like a technique that we use in user experience design. And then let's see, I think at that point it was like fall heading into winter. We were continuing to refine the prototype.
Maybe that's very interesting because you have this, you know, design vision and background. So I think many engineers who work on open outdoor project don't have it at all, and they wouldn't think maybe of doing a persona document. How does this work? Like you create it's like, you know, I don't know, a PowerPoint or a picture, or like, how do you do that?
Yeah, I think I like to keep them really simple because you want them to be living documents, because the first time you create a persona, it's often based on, you know, very limited data, a lot of assumptions, just kind of gut level. But you're like, here's the persona that I think is emerging based on my interviews and my ethnography. And I put together just like a simple one page document per persona. It always has an image of a real person, not a cartoon. And it's different than a segment. So there might be some supporting demographics, but only to the degree that it creates a more fleshed out picture of a real human. But you give them a name. One of ours is Edwin. He's like I haven't looked at the persona in a while, but I think he's like a 27-year-old developer in the Bay Area, you know, working for a software-based tech company, but he's interested in hardware and he goes to maker spaces after work to hack on like simple robotics projects, like beginner level robotics projects. And so it's much more about psychographics, so behavioral information. So you actually might even end up with two personas that demographically are identical. You know, you might have two 27-year-old males, but behaviorally they're really different because they have different motivating factors. They have different needs and different goals. Ours do end up being demographically different. And I think, in fact, it's time for us to revisit our personas because I think we have more data now to support probably an additional persona. But what's helpful is once you have that archetype built up, when you're going into product level decisions, you're like, should we include this feature? Well, does Edwin want that? You know, and you can talk about it, in a less, it makes the conversation a little bit less about you and what you want to see and more about like, let's put this through the eyes of the customer. What do they actually need based on what we know about what their goals are?
Mm-hmm. Interesting. So you use it on a regular basis when you have big features to decide.
You get to know the persona really well, so you don't always, I mean, it's great if you're in an office with your team just to have them on the wall, you know, as a constant reminder, but eventually you just kind of absorb the persona, you have them in your mind as a character, and then you just refer to them in conversation. So, you know, if Edwin's goal is to do basic robotics projects, does he really need like his own way of selling his apps that he's creating? Maybe not. Like, he's more of a hobbyist at this point.
Maybe let's talk about the campaign, the crowdfunding campaign.
Sure.
I have questions about the rewards. How did you decide on the, you know, the pricing? That's a problem that I found very frequent in open outdoor project. Is I don't know how much I do really need and how much would be my product.
Yeah.
And so how did you estimate that?
Right.
You know, decide on something that would be realistic.
Yeah, I think, I think if I recall, Eric took that on, and I think he took our bill of materials, and then he talked to different companies who could do the PCB manufacturing and the assembly, and got quotes at different levels, like different volumes. And that did help create a threshold. Like, we need to at least sell this much volume to get like a reasonable rate on assembly and on PCB manufacturing. Because if we'd done maybe, I don't know, like a, I'll just throw out an arbitrary number. If we'd done a goal of $5,000, and we'd gotten back at only that level, it would have been such a small run of production that probably the price per board would have been astronomically high. And so basically we just planned out like, okay, how are we going to get this thing produced? What's it going to cost to get it produced? What do we expect the packaging to cost? Shipping, all those extraneous things, you know, even dunnage, the packing materials that you put inside of the box that it ships in. and we created a budget around that. And we said, okay, we used, Chris Anderson in a lot of his, talking he's been doing about the maker movement. I think maybe in his book Makers, but at the time he had a blog series, maybe on the, I want to say the Etsy blog, but now that sounds, that sounds wrong. We had a series of blog posts about, maker businesses and kind of rules of thumb for going after this type of project. And his suggestion was, make sure that you mark up, between 2.3 to 2.6 beyond what it costs to manufacture this thing. And that'll cover the cost in the future of, well, it'll cover the cost of like unknowns. You know, there's things you need to account for. You know, there's going to be some level of failure, like some number of PCBs just simply won't work and they won't make it to the assembly stage. And also like covering the cost of if you start to work with resellers. So we were really trying to shoot for what would ultimately be our retail price later. I don't know if that was the right way to go or not. I mean, maybe we could have charged more and then later brought down the retail price, but we still expect our retail price to be the same as what the Indiegogo perks were priced at.
How much is a Pinocchio board?
The starter kit, which has two boards, one including Wi-Fi, is $149 US. And then if you want just a single board with no Wi-Fi, that's $49. If you want a single board with Wi-Fi, that's $99. Yeah, and we were also trying to, you know, we were watching, like, we're reading a lot about best ways to conduct a crowdfunding campaign and trying to offer different price points. Like, Pinocchio does become a lot more interesting once you have more than one board. So the starter kit is really the atomic unit that we suggest. Like, having two boards really does let you start doing some basic mesh networking stuff. But being able to offer a single board with no Wi-Fi, you know, it's maybe not as compelling for using it with our web app, but at least you've got essentially like a tiny pocket-sized Arduino Mega that's running on a rechargeable battery. Like, so that's kind of interesting, and that lets you get something for $49.
So the campaign was a huge success, right? You raised more than $100,000 from an initial goal of $60,000.
That's right.
So that's really impressive.
Thank you so much.
Congrats. Yeah. How do you explain the success? What are the main reasons for it?
Well, let's see. I mean, I think, first of all, we try to do a ton of research about how to conduct a crowdfunding campaign before we started. so we did stuff like we compiled a list of all of our personal contacts, and then we compiled a separate list of press contacts who had covered similar stories in the past. Maybe they'd covered, you know, microcontroller-centric hardware crowdfunding campaigns. And so first we, when the campaign first went live, you know, we were trying to prime our friends and family. We told them that we were about to go live with it. Once it went live, we emailed all the people that we know personally and we said, hey, here's our campaign. Like, we'd love it if you could just back us for $5. We'll send you like a patch or, you know, a sticker. Or if you're willing to like share it out to your networks and try to spread the word. So that kind
of, yeah. So try to have some sort of momentum.
Exactly.
Going.
Yep. And then we waited to contact the press until there was some momentum that it started from our friends and family. And it was wonderful. Like, we had like good buddies and family members who early on like gave us really generous, backed us in really generous ways. And because Eric and I are pretty embedded in the tech industry, our friends and family group, at least our friend group, like, does tend to be basically our target customer. So we do have a lot of buddies who are like, I'm actually really interested in playing with this. Like, I do want to have a Pinocchio. So that helped too. And then,
Would you say that past work experiences and working at Yahoo and all helps in a way, or not really?
I think so. I think if nothing else, it helped to have that network. Because a lot of the folks that I work with at Yahoo, you know, some years have passed since then, and they're all at Twitter and Facebook and Google and Instagram and everywhere else. So, or not Instagram. I don't think I know anybody at Instagram. That's like a 10-person team still, right?
Yeah.
But they're all at these, like,
and it's Facebook now.
It's Facebook now. Yeah. So technically, yeah. So that probably helped too. Like, they could spread the word within their networks, and their networks were, you know, somewhat tapped in technologists who would probably be interested in this product.
Mm-hmm. So that actually happened, like, by email or just people, word of mouth, people talking to their friends? Or...
Yep, by email. We had like a pre-written email that we sent out to friends and family, and we tried to tailor it, you know, specifically. Like, if there's someone you haven't talked to, if it's your best friend and you talked to them yesterday, you send them a form email, they know what's going on, it's fine. But if it's somebody you haven't talked to in 6 months, it's kind of a jerk move to just be like, hey, we don't really talk anymore, but can you do me this favor? Yeah. So, you know, you try to like catch up and ask how they're doing and, try not to be a total douche about it. But now I think crowdfunding's been around long enough where we kind of get it. Like, when you get that email from a friend who's like, hey, back my campaign, you're like, okay, that's cool. Like, I totally want to support my friend, and it's okay if they didn't.
Yeah, it's almost like a, hey, here's what's up in my life.
True.
I'm doing
it's
this.
True. It's like, here's what I've been working on for the last year. Here's why you haven't heard from me in a few months, because I've been heads down doing this. Yeah.
So you got a lot of press press attention?
Yeah, some of that was just like total shot in the dark. I mean, we actually did have a contact at Make from one of these conferences that we'd gone to. He was really supportive, and he was like, well, you know, like, keep me posted. I want to hear how this goes. This is a really interesting product. So he blogged about us, which was wonderful. One of my heroes, Bruce Sterling, has a blog for Wired. He's a science fiction writer. And in fact, like, one of his early books was a really strong influence on Pinocchio. Like, some of his thinking early on that was like theoretical futuristic stuff, you know, and this book it's called Shaping Things. It's probably 8 years old now. Some of these things are starting to come to fruition. And I reread the book as I started to work on Pinocchio just to get some inspiration. So just shot in the dark. I don't know him personally, but I just emailed him and I was like, hey, we're working on Pinocchio. Shaping Things is like really big inspiration. And he was like, yeah, sure, I'll blog about that. So like, that was a dream come true. That was a really
cool. Yeah. Wow.
So it never hurts just to try, you know, somebody can always just delete your email. It doesn't hurt as long as you're like, you know, thoughtful and polite about it.
Did the crowdfunding campaign was your number one plan A? And did you have a plan B in case of problems? What happened? What would have happened if the campaign did not succeed? Would you have kept going?
Yeah, good question. I mean, because that was totally possible that we wouldn't get funded and then it would kind of be back to the drawing board. I think we were prepared to just, we were so passionate about this idea. We were like, okay, if it doesn't get funded, that just means one, we're either something's kind of off about the product, like we haven't exactly hit what it is that people need, or two, we have created something people need, we're not doing a good job of communicating it. And in fact, there is some of that that happens during the campaign. Like, you'll start to see the same question pouring in, and it's clear that you know, there's some misunderstanding about some feature. But it's wonderful because it's web-based, so you can clarify and you can iterate your materials as you go based on the questions that people are sending in. But I think plan two is just bootstrap. You know, we'd been bootstrapping for, I guess, the 6 months prior at that point. And, you know, crowdfunding, the way we priced it, it covered the cost of the perks that we were going to get, but it wasn't like we were able to draw a salary off of that. So we continued to bootstrap. Like, I think, yeah, we were bootstrapping for at least a solid year. So we were just like, it'll be a bummer if we don't get funded, but it'll be instructive and we'll learn from it and we'll just keep going. We'll like iterate, you know, and maybe even try a crowdfunding campaign again once we've evolved the product based on the feedback that we got. But We were so thrilled. Like, we didn't expect to break the 100,000 mark. And when we did, we were totally celebrating. And then even to get like 5,000 more than that, we were just over the moon.
So when you say bootstrapping, does it mean that you you kept going on the freelancing activities on the side?
Yeah,
or working part-time on the project?
Yeah.
And
like,
the same with Eric? Or?
Eric was working full-time. He was just working like a maniac. He's got an amazing work ethic. And I think I was like, I don't think I can split my brain, you know, on two massive creative projects. So I was just like working off of my savings for a while. Great. Thanks. It's fun to talk to you.
And that's it. As all entrepreneur stories, this one too is to be continued. And you will be interested to know that Pinocchio has already started to be manufactured and will be ready for shipping in June. You can already pre-order on the website. I hope you got some interesting insights and inspiration coming from what Sally tells about in this episode. I thought it was full of interesting methodologies and just simple good advice on how to get going using personas, using contacts and personal professional experience to build your network and start communicating and start doing beta testing in a very lean way. So I thought that was very easy to activate this advice. And thanks for listening, and see you soon for a new episode of the Making Society podcast. It's always a pleasure to be with you. Bye.